We are back. Tomorrow is the 39th anniversary of the assassination of John Kennedy. The murder of our 35th president remains the subject of endless conjecture and fascination. The official explanation of what happened fails to convince most Americans that there was no conspiracy. No man did more to sway the public that Lee Oswald was the real lone nut assassin than FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. We are privileged to air here on Radio Parallax an exclusive interview with investigative journalist William Turner. Bill Turner was the first whistleblower to attack the credibility of J. Edgar Hoover. Amazingly, he did so as an active field agent of the FBI at a time when Hoover was regarded as more powerful than the president. Turner went on to author numerous articles and 9 books, most recently Rearview Mirror, Looking Back at the FBI, CIA, and Other Tales, a compelling overview of William Turner's most interesting career. Building on 10 years of experience as a G-man, Turner applied his skills to numerous curiosities, including the question of what really happened in Dallas in 1963. He made several fascinating findings and we're keen to let him tell you about a few of them today. Conducting our interview is educator James DiEugenio, author of Destiny Betrayed, a look at the Jim Garrison investigation popularized by Oliver Stone in his 1991 movie, JFK. Jim was also editor of Probe, an investigative magazine. As the interview commenced, Jim asked Bill how it is he got started in the FBI in the first place.
And I joined the FBI when I was 23, and I wasn't very mature. I'd been in World War II, and came out patriotic, of course. And I had always, as a kid, read stories about the derring do, the FBI breaking up the gangbusters in the Midwest, Dillinger and Ma Barker and her boys, and Alvin Creepy Carpus, the Urschel kidnapping Machine Gun Kelly. So I thought, I need some adventure. That's for me.
All right. So obviously back then there had not been anywhere near the exposure of what the FBI was really all about as we have today.
That's correct.
Right.
But I can tell you this. When I reported for duty in the Department of Justice building in 1951, we had in our new agents class some people who had been bureau clerks in Washington and knew the story, and they warned us about...
Oh, they did?
You know, Hoover will be gone pretty soon, but in the meantime, keep your head down and don't get involved too much.
How long were you there?
I was in the Bureau for 10 years, and I served in St. Louis, San Francisco, Seattle, Oklahoma City, and Knoxville.
And what was your area of expertise?
Well, I had several areas. I did criminal investigations. I did counter-espionage investigations. I did burglaries, wiretaps, and bugs. I was a relief supervisor, and I was an inspector.
The part of the book which details your sort of disenchantment with Hoover and your kind of mini-campaign to try and bring some of the abuses and the inefficiencies of the Bureau to the public's attention is probably one of the most interesting parts of the book, sort of a David and Goliath kind of thing. You've only been in the Bureau a few years, and here you're trying to take down the dictator.
Yeah, and here I had all these letters of commendation from Hoover telling me how great I was on burglaries and, and so, breaking up bank robberies and everything. I think he was a little surprised.
What began your disenchantment with the Bureau and J. Edgar?
Well, like I said, when I first got in the Bureau, they let it be known that this was a rather strange culture. During the years that I was in the Bureau, I learned that all Hoover was trying to do was pile up criminal statistics as opposed, you know, running after car thieves and the human tumbleweeds of crime, as opposed to going after organized crime. That was a main source of disillusion. Mm-hmm. Also, the cult of personality that surrounded him and the fact that he was bulletproof when it came to Congress. Congress wouldn't listen to any idea that he might be, because of his files. He had the files, and if a member of Congress didn't have a file on him, they thought they did. All this accumulated, and I was going to leave the Bureau. I had, matter of fact, applied with the CIA, and they interviewed me before I left the Bureau. I didn't go with the CIA because the Bay of Pigs kind of disillusioned me about the agency, but I had wanted to continue in government service, but with some outfit other than the FBI. But I thought, look, I've got 10 years invested in this thing. I know the problems with the Bureau. Why don't I just try to get some rectification before I leave? The question was, should I write a hearts and flowers letter to Hoover and leave and then do it, or should I poke the tiger from inside the cage and get fired? Well, I decided to poke the tiger from inside the cage.
A lot of people, for the life of them, could not understand why Hoover would not go after whatever you want to call it, the mob, the mafia. Why was Hoover so leery about going after organized crime in the United States?
Well, Summers takes a position that he was compromised by organized crime through photos, sexual photos. And it's all so abstract. It's anecdotal. I'm real agnostic on whether he was compromised by organized crime. And I'm really doubtful of the cross-dressing episode ever happened. Not that he didn't have what we used to call an unwholesome relationship with Clyde Tolson as associate.
Who was Clyde Tolson?
Clyde Tolson was associate director of the FBI, constant companion of J. Edgar Hoover. But
would he be proper to call him the number two guy at the FBI?
Number two guy is correct.
Okay. And he was also best friends.
Also best, the significant other.
Right.
Bill is referring at this point to the biography of J. Edgar Hoover done by author Anthony Summers, which contains the explosive allegations that Hoover was compromised because the mob possessed incriminating photos and information about his relationship with Clyde Tolson. A relationship that Summers and others would point out clearly indicates that the two men represented a homosexual couple.
I disagree with Summers on that. I think the reason that Hoover didn't go after organized crime was twofold. Number one, he created the FBI image and mystique of gangbusters during the 30s, going after people that weren't involved with organized crime. Individual outlaws roaming the Midwest, shoot 'em up kind of stuff. And I felt that he thought that organized crime was too tough for him to crack.
Too sophisticated?
Too sophisticated, too moneyed, top lawyers, the whole bit. He didn't want to get bitten. They wouldn't be easy headlines. And I think the other part of it was, I think that he was kind of mobbed up himself. Like
he had some friends and associates.
He had Frank Costello, the capo in New York. He'd meet on a park bench for tips on the horse races that were fixed. Costello, in turn, had an axis with Carlos Marcello. And you'll notice that even after the organized crime attack began, the campaign against organized crime that was pushed by Bobby Kennedy, that those two particular organized crime section chiefs were left alone.
Once you make this decision that you're going to try and go after Hoover before you leave, what were some of the devices and some of the plans that you had on bringing this attention to people in power?
My program, if you want to call it that, and I was backed up by Nelson Skip Gibbons, who was a legend in the FBI for single-handedly cracking a Soviet espionage ring. He felt the way I did, and he allowed me to be his spokesman. I wrote letters to Congress asking for a congressional investigation of the FBI. And so we were in Oklahoma at the time, Gibbons and myself, and they sent him to Butte, Montana, and me to Knoxville, Tennessee to break us up. In the meantime, kind of trying to starve us out. He wouldn't quit, neither would I quit. And when FBI inspector showed up and asked him, "What's your intention?" he said, "I don't know, what's yours?" So they finally gave him a stressed discharge from the FBI with a pension. So he became a ski instructor, and I called him the only totally disabled ski instructor in the world.
Mm-hmm. What'd you do next?
Well, I was interviewed by Senator Javits of New York and Kefauver of Tennessee, who knew organized crime problem. And he said, "I know what you're talking about, Bill, but, you know, Hoover's more powerful than the president." So I had veterans' rights as a veteran of World War II, and I wouldn't quit. They were on me to quit, and they held me under house arrest down in Knoxville, Tennessee. And I just wouldn't. I just wrote more letters. And finally, I got a call from a mole in Washington, D.C., and said, the letter you want is on the way. And sure enough, they drew up this bill of particulars, and that they were, in fact, I was lying because they were, in fact, doing something about organized crime, all that kind of nitpicking. And so I flew up to Washington and called Edward Bennett Williams' office, and who had been the chief counsel or the lawyer for Senator Joseph McCarthy and Jimmy Hoffa. And he took my case pro bono.
I should mention at this point that Edward Bennett Williams was the legendary, powerful Washington, D.C. attorney. He was the attorney for Joe McCarthy, Bobby Baker, Jimmy Hoffa, and many other notables. And that once Bill went to visit Williams, he obtained a valuable and powerful ally.
So we had a lawsuit going. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and it got turned down there by one swing vote, recalling the election in Florida, kind of the same scenario. But Chief Justice Earl Warren voted for me. And they just needed Hugo Black, and he was in transition from being a liberal to conservative, and so we didn't quite make it.
What was the case about? What were you going to
do? The constitutional right of a government employee to inform Congress of the manner in which a public agency is discharging its public trust.
In other words,
that my letters were privileged under the Constitution, and they could not retaliate against me for communicating with Congress.
So you were the forerunner of the modern whistleblower.
There you go.
So you actually wrote a letter to Bobby Kennedy, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
All right, and what happened to that one?
He said, I sent him a telegram. I was skiing at Aspen when I was put on leave by the FBI, suspended by the FBI, and I wrote him a telegraph, and he sends back a telegraph collect. Says cost me $2.50 to get his lousy... and he says, suggest you contact Director FBI. Bobby could be a runt, I'll tell you.
All right. So in other words, your campaign eventually ended up that you really couldn't accomplish much.
Right.
All right. You never got an open hearing.
Not in the climate of those days.
No. And you never got called before Congress.
Not until much later. I was called before Kastenmeier's committee on electronic bugging and wiretapping in the 70s when the reform, after Hoover died, Congress gets a backbone to try and get them a charter and reform them. Right. And that's when I testified.
You know, let's talk about something that probably the public doesn't really understand, since there's been a lot of talk about the so-called secret files of J. Edgar Hoover. And there was actually a congressional investigation to find the so-called secret files of J. Edgar Hoover.
Well, I can tell them where they were. Down right. By the exhibit section in the basement.
There was actually at least two separate files then. There was one that any FBI agent could access.
That's true.
To get information.
Right.
But there was a set that only Hoover himself or one of his courtiers or court jesters, whatever you want to call them, could file. And those were for basically his purposes, correct?
Yes.
All right.
They were kept in his safe.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but basically this consisted of, let's call it scurrilous or uncomplimentary information on people that had some kind of degree of power in the Washington, New York City axis.
Yes, and it was accumulated mostly from the field offices. The field offices were instructed that anything that might be helpful with regard to a public figure or a member of Congress or whoever, politician, be sent to Washington. So you would excerpt this stuff from the file, the main file. Say it was a bank robbery case, and you happened across something deleterious to a public official, that had to be sent to Washington.
And a lot of this stuff, from what I've read, really was not the most reliable or accurate information.
No, it wasn't. A lot of it was picked up through illegal surveillance, but a lot of it also was gossip, corrupted informants, news clips.
It's not like this stuff was held in threat He actually did use this stuff.
Oh, yeah. He would send Deke DeLoach, the head of the Crime Records Division, over to see, say, a senator. And DeLoach would say, "Senator, we have this information that came to our attention, very derogatory to you, but please be assured that we will keep it secret." Now, you know, Congress wasn't born yesterday.
Right.
And, I mean, it was a blackmail is what it was.
Exactly.
You're listening to a Radio Parallax exclusive, an interview with author, former FBI agent, and investigative journalist William Turner, conducted for us by James DiEugenio.
After your campaign against Hoover, you then embarked on a career in journalism.
That's true.
One of the very first things you tried to do was to write this book about Hoover and the FBI.
Yes. And I had it in a initial draft form. I remember it was submitted to Doubleday by my literary agent, and they loved it. And they sat on it, and they sat on it. They couldn't bring themselves to you know, it was just too dangerous, they felt. So it took me until 1970 to get it published. I got my FBI file, and it's 17 volumes, and in it is that Hoover ordered a book review by the FBI. The Domestic Intelligence Division had to address parts of the book that dealt with that. Administrative Division, the lab, the Criminal Division, they all had to write their own book reviews of the part of my book that dealt. I guess it probably would have cost about $3 million in agents' time, and I'm not kidding, in dollars in those days for them to do this book review. And then what they did, they fed it to Jeremiah O'Leary, the Washington Star, who put it in print. And, of course, you know, it just ripped the book and me.
Do you think there was anything behind the scenes maneuvering people in certain places? Not...
Well, I know there was because my FBI file. It's very clear they were trying every way to keep track of my writings and submarine everything I did. It was censorship by stealth.
For more interesting anecdotes about William Turner's career in the FBI years, I would refer you to his book, Hoover's FBI, The Men and the Myth, as well as his more recent effort, Rearview Mirror. In this next portion, Jim DiEugenio asks William Turner about his career as an investigative journalist, opening with his assignment for Saga magazine to go down and cover the events in Dallas taking place on the weekend of the Kennedy assassination in 1963. Saga magazine sent Bill down to cover what appeared to be the obvious breakdown in security story surrounding the Kennedy murder.
What had happened was the magazine was going to do a profile of me as the FBI's first whistleblower. This was in 1963, just before the Kennedy assassination. When the Kennedy assassination happened, they called me and said, "We're changing the assignment. Get yourself down to Dallas and do a story on the breakdown in security. And we need the story done right away. You're going to only have about 3 days in Dallas." So I did. I went down there, flew down the same day Ruby was knocking off Oswald, and did it. A three-day investigation, and came back and wrote the story. As a matter of fact, I used some FBI sources, and what they told me was that 10 days before the assassination, an agent by the name of W. Harlan Brown and James Hostie, his younger companion, has especially interviewed Oswald, and the Warren Commission put that under heads of speculation and rumors. But I also found out the same source that told me later, apparently didn't think it all that important, later told me, a month later, says, "Oh, by the way, Oswald was an FBI informant. They were running him as a potential security informant, a PSI, and he was doing Neutrality Act stuff," which ties in, of course, with the Buddy Walters report about Oswald frequenting a radical Cuban exile group, Cuban Student Directorate, out on Harlandale Avenue, not far from where Oswald was under an assumed name in the boarding house.
Bill is referring to a report by a Dallas police officer that Oswald was known to be frequenting a house where radical Cuban students were known to assemble. This, of course, has great relevance in asking the question of who Oswald was and what he was up to. But let's not get ahead of ourselves.
When you say Neutrality Act stuff, do you mean like the monitoring of possible attacks against
the illegal trafficking in guns?
Right.
Which they were using, they were contemplating a second invasion of Cuba.
Right.
So Oswald was an FBI informant, so that kind of puts a whole new angle on who he was and where he was coming from, and probably the infiltration of the DRE resulted in him being set up as a patsy.
Now, you said you were sent there to talk about the, or write about the security breakdown. What did you find out about that?
Well, I found out that the FBI never passed on to the Secret Service this information about Oswald, and probably because they were using him as an informant, and which illustrates the same kind of problem we had up in Boston recently with an FBI agent who is now 10 years in jail for protecting an informant who was allowing the people he was informing on, Whitey Bulger, to kill 19 people. So it's a parallel case. And that's why I figured FBI didn't advise the Secret Service.
I don't know how many people in the audience will understand what a vast and important subject that is. Because really, basically, the way organizations like the FBI and the CIA and the Secret Service find out things that the general public doesn't know is through the use of what we call, quote, unquote, informants.
Correct.
Yeah, and the function of most FBI officers or CIA officers is basically to run what they call either agents or informants in the field.
Well, you have to understand the FBI is very limited in its use of undercover. In fact, in my day, we never had agents go undercover. The reason was you had to look like an IBM salesman. Right. And, you know, you wouldn't fit into ethnic groups. You wouldn't fit into these you didn't look like a hood.
Mm-hmm.
They relied on informants instead, and informants are part of the meal. And they're working for money mostly. So you have a very untrustworthy situation there, a very unstable kind of situation that can blow up in your face at any time. So that's a reason for the FBI's dependence on informants as opposed to undercover agents. Undercover agents are used by the CIA and all. And a lot of police departments, metropolitan police departments, they use undercover agents because they're screened, they're on their payroll, they're full-time employees of that agency and subject to the trustworthiness of that agency. Informants are not.
But they're paid, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. You pay them according to what they turn in. A potential security informant can become a full-fledged, or a potential criminal informant can become a full-fledged informant with a symbol number, and he's paid on a regular basis because he's already proven that he can, on a continuing basis, that was their criteria, on a continuing basis furnish the information. Then he's a full-fledged informant and getting paid, but he's still not under control.
If an informant is not a real law enforcement officer, and if he gets paid by the amount of reliable or whatever information he hands into you, and if you get credit for running this so-called informant, isn't there a tendency to sometimes, once you've passed the threshold test of actually giving information simply because you want to remain on the retainer?
Of course. Exaggerate, even fantasize.
Or sometimes create things.
Or create situations.
Right.
And that works both ways. It works on the other side, too. The FBI agent working criminal work, the FBI agent working security work, is under a quota system to produce informants. You have to have so many informants, a combination of potential security informants and full-fledged security informants or full-fledged criminal informants, you're under the gun there to produce that certain number. So a lot of times agents, they'd come to me and say, well, how do you develop an informant? And I said, well, you know, I can't tell you. There's nothing. You got to do it. And you can't go home at 5 o'clock. So there was a lot of exaggeration going on in what they reported, because their payday depended on it, and the agent was under a quota system to produce informants that were producing.
So this gets interesting as to the role of Lee Harvey Oswald. Many people believe that Oswald's status was really as a step beyond an informant to what some people have called an agent provocateur.
Well, an agent provocateur would be somebody who goes in and stirs up the organization he's infiltrated to do something criminal, destabilize it, or to make it subject to arrest. Mm-hmm. In other words, a lot of crimes are committed because an agent provocateur is, we've seen that on the campuses in the 60s, agent provocateurs all over the place whipping up the crowd, and then the cops move in and arrest.
Right. Okay.
So that's basically what it is.
If Oswald was an informant or an agent provocateur working for either the FBI or the CIA, all right, this, of course, would not be something that either Hoover or Richard Helms at the CIA or any other high honcho would ever want to be revealed.
I mean, the FBI is always, to this day, are very protective of the identity of their informants, mm-hmm. and rarely give them up their names. Even when their usefulness is ended, it's still difficult to get the name of an informant. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Hoover very much protected informants, the FBI under Hoover. I don't know if you're aware of it, but John Newman, a few years ago, talked to one of the agents in Kansas City who had worked with Hastie, and Hastie admitted to him that Oswald was an informant.
Right. And, you know, this is something that writers on the Kennedy assassination have always seriously suspected, that one of the reasons for the massive cover-up at the FBI was right. to cover up the fact that Oswald was really an informant for Hoover.
Yeah. And, you know, Hoover, the Warren Commission let Hoover off easy. He comes in and tells them Oswald was not an informant. Now, that's open to so many semantic interpretations. Maybe he meant that he wasn't a paid criminal informant. Maybe he meant he wasn't a symbol number informant.
Whatever the explanation, the Warren Commission did not really challenge Hoover's rather, you know, lacking in substance denial, right?
That's true. And you know that Hale Boggs, who was a member of the commission, said that Hoover lied through his teeth
later on
just about everything they asked him. Mm-hmm. And there were some members of the commission that refused to immediately sign off on the Warren Commission report because they felt the FBI and its director were untrustworthy.
You are listening to an exclusive Radio Parallax interview with author and investigative journalist William Turner, conducted by James DiEugenio. The relationship of alleged assassin Lee Harvey Oswald to the federal government, both the agencies of the FBI and the CIA, is a very open and interesting question to this day. In the wake of Oliver Stone's movie 10 years ago, the Assassination Records Review Board went to declassify all the information related to the assassination that didn't bear on national security. The CIA decided that it had numerous filing cabinets filled with information on Lee Harvey Oswald that shouldn't see the light of day. It basically outweighed the Records Review Board. Their mandate ended after a few years, and those files still remain in Langley, Virginia, unopened. We need to take a short break in this very interesting interview, and let's do so. I'm Douglas Everett, and you're listening to KDVS 90.3 FM.